Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Bring the world closer with podcasts from the BBC World Service. Unmissable stories from around the globe.
Whoa.
Search for the documentary Lives Less Ordinary and Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You better be ready, because we're going to bring it to you.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 14 hours GMT on the 10th of January, these are our main stories. People in Ecuador are living under a state of emergency after drug gangs took over a TV station and fought gun battles with police on the streets.
I hope that this state of emergency yields results, positive results for the population.
On a day-to-day basis, when we go out to work, we don't know if we'll return or if we'll come back home in one piece.
And who will run Gaza after the war is over? The US Secretary of State has been meeting the man who may hold the key to Palestinian unity. Also in this podcast, bribery and match fixing in Chinese football. What happened to President Xi's dream of dominating the beautiful game? And as Taiwan goes to the polls this weekend, there's an elephant in the room.
I'm Taiwanese, but my ancestors come from China. We have the same blood.
I am definitely Taiwanese, but I think there is no way for us to separate from China.
We begin in Ecuador, where at least 10 people have been killed since a state of emergency began on Monday after a notorious gangster vanished from his prison cell. Gangs responded by setting off car bombs and attacking buildings. On Tuesday, masked gunmen broke into a live television studio in the city of Guayaquil, forcing people to lie on the floor. Presenter Jorge Rendon was in the studio when the attack took place.
They shot one of our cameramen in the leg, broke the arm of another one. They fired bullets, they used their weapons inside. The police were alerted and they came in minutes, surrounded the TV station, and the tactical units intervened. They fired shots. The gunmen were heavily armed, had long-range weapons and wore balaclavas.
On the streets of the capital, Quito, there's a real sense of fear about what could happen next.
I hope that this state of emergency yields results, positive results for the population, not for the criminals.
We live in constant fear because on a day-to-day basis when we go out to work, we don't know if we'll return or if we'll come back home in one piece.
Well, their concern is understandable. Here's a statement from one of the gangs. You declared a state of emergency. We declare police, civilians and soldiers to be the spoils of war. President Daniel Noboa has now authorised the military to neutralise, in his words, a number of armed groups. I asked Vanessa Busch-Schluter, our Latin America online editor, whether that's possible.
Legally, he can. That's why he issued this decree. This gives the soldiers the force or the power to shoot at sight at suspected gang members. However, the question is, what will it change in practice? Because, of course, he has also published a list of the 22 gangs that he has declared as terrorist gangs. But those gangs were known before. So many people in Ecuador are asking, why weren't these measures taken before if these people were known and had launched attacks as early as last year, when, of course, you will remember a presidential candidate was assassinated by these gangs?
And Daniel Noboa came into office late last year. He's 36-year-old. He came in saying, look, we're going to stem the drug trade. I mentioned the fact that it used to be a relative bastion of calm, Ecuador, in a very violent region. Why has this been happening recently, over the recent years?
Absolutely right, Nick. It used to be a relatively calm country, but its geographical location has given it that disadvantage of being sandwiched between Colombia and Peru, which are the two largest cocaine producers in the whole world. And because Ecuador was relatively calm, its police force was not as well trained to deal with armed gangs, not as well trained as those of Colombia, for example, the police force and the army there. So international cocaine gangs realized that and saw an opportunity to move into Ecuador and smuggle the cocaine that is produced in Colombia and in Peru through Ecuador, which has large ports, into the US. So they took advantage of the relative calmness of Ecuador. And of course, as that has gone on, and international cartels like the Sinaloa cartel and the Cartel Jalisco Nueva Generación, two major Mexican cartels, have moved in, this violence has just exploded in Ecuador.
That was Vanessa Buschluter. On Saturday, Taiwan will elect a new president, an election that China has called a choice between peace and war. Taiwan's separation from China is seen in Beijing as an aberration, an unresolved issue from China's civil war. In 1949, the victorious communists drove China's nationalist leader, Chiang Kai-shek, from power. He fled to Taiwan, setting up a rival government there. But today, Taiwan is a democracy and its people are free to choose the government they want. And as our correspondent Rupert Wingfield Hayes has been finding out, 75 years on, fewer and fewer people there feel any attachment to China.
I have come to a very surreal place about an hour south of Taipei. I'm in a park surrounded by forest, and this park is full, I mean full, of statues of one man, Chiang Kai-shek. I've come here with a 94-year-old veteran of Chiang's army. Fan fled China along with hundreds of thousands of nationalist soldiers. He's been in Taiwan for 75 years, but has never stopped feeling Chinese.
Taiwan is a province. It is still a part of China. Slowly, the differences between us will narrow until we are the same. Then we can achieve unification.
Chiang Kai-shek tried to turn Taiwan into a mini version of the China he'd left behind. Taipei's streets are still named after important Chinese cities. People here were taught there was no such thing as being Taiwanese. So that's the sound of them changing guard at the Chiang Kai-shek Memorial in the middle of Taipei. This enormous marble edifice still dominates the centre of the city, with a huge statue of Chiang Kai-shek sitting, gazing down at his subjects. Chiang's project to turn Taiwanese people into good citizens of China ultimately failed. Today, around 70% of people here say they are Taiwanese, not Chinese. This heavy steel gate is at the entranceway to a cell block in what was called the Jingmei Detention Centre. And it's where they brought political prisoners to be put on trial and imprisoned for political crime. 86-year-old John Chen shows me the bare concrete cell where he spent 10 years for supporting Taiwan independence. He's one of around 140,000 locked up for opposing Chiang Kai-shek's rule.
I don't consider myself Chinese. Taiwan is already a great country, but due to the influence of the Chinese Communist Party, we can't declare independence. The current mainland and Taiwan are, of course, very different. My feeling is that we share the same ethnicity, which is true, but in terms of culture and habits, it's still quite different.
Much has changed since the days of military dictatorship. Taiwan is now a fully fledged democracy, and people here are about to vote for a new president. In a small city on Taiwan's west coast, Chiang Kai-shek's old nationalist party, the KMT, is holding a noisy nighttime rally. Today, the KMT campaigns on having good relations with China, but no one talks of unification.
I'm Taiwanese, but my ancestors come from China. We have the same blood.
I am definitely Taiwanese, but I think at this stage, there is no way for us to separate from China. I think the current situation is really good. Just keep it as it is now.
Taiwan is very different from China. It has dozens of political parties and noisy, energetic elections. People here are free to choose who they are and how to live. Most say they are Taiwanese, not Chinese, and they don't want that to change.
Rupert Wingfield Hayes reporting. The war in Gaza shows no sign of reducing in intensity, but already diplomats are considering what happens when it does. Who will govern the Strip? How will it be rebuilt? And who will pay for it all? The US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, has been in the West Bank meeting Mahmoud Abbas, the head of the Palestinian Authority, which Washington hopes could take political control of Gaza after the conflict ends. It's a follow-on from Mr. Blinken's talks with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Tel Aviv on Tuesday, in which he criticised Israel for undermining the Palestinians' ability to govern themselves. Yolan Nell is our correspondent in Jerusalem.
Of course, Washington is looking to the Palestinian Authority to be a big part of post-war plans for governance in Gaza, but it is stressing that reforms are badly needed. There has been a suggestion that perhaps there could be a shift towards a technocratic government for the Palestinians, one that could have control in future over both the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip. But there's a long way to go before that can happen. And of course, this is another opportunity for Mr. Blinken to reiterate that he's interested in this idea of regional integration. He's not been really expecting any breakthroughs in talks he's had with the Israelis, but he's been really pressing for the idea of a practical pathway to be laid out for the creation of a Palestinian state, saying that many countries in the region, Arab neighbours of Israel, are ready to invest in the future of Gaza if they have that idea of an end in sight to the decades-long Israel-Palestinian conflict.
Clearly, one of the problems at the moment is Mr. Abbas's credibility and political legitimacy amongst Palestinians. It is very low, isn't it?
That's right. And his popularity ratings have fallen even lower during the course of this war, with a suspicion among the Palestinian public that the unpopular Palestinian Authority leaders could be seen to be going into Gaza on the back of an Israeli tank, to use a popular phrase around here. That is something that the Palestinian Authority is only too aware of. I'm sure Washington is only too aware of as well. So there will have to be greater steps taken towards boosting the credibility, the legitimacy, revitalizing the Palestinian Authority.
And another concern for Mr. Blinken is a wider escalation of violence in the region, and that's highlighted by a big uptick in the drones and missiles being fired by the Houthis from Yemen, isn't it?
Indeed, and we've had what is being described by the British Defence Secretary as the largest attack by the Houthis to date in the Red Sea. And we know that a British naval ship, along with US warships, was involved in repelling that, destroying multiple attack drones. Something like 20 of these attack drones, along with missiles, were fired from Yemen, it seems, towards international shipping lanes. That's what the US Central Command says, where dozens of merchant vessels were transiting.
That was Yolan Nell. Hearings begin at the International Court of Justice in The Hague today on the genocide case brought against Israel by South Africa. The court is part of the UN. Its business is often territorial disputes, but there have been and there are now some cases involving genocide allegations, including against Russia and Myanmar. Israel says the case is baseless, but it's taking it very seriously, as we heard from our international editor, Jeremy Bowen.
Even though they have condemned it, they've said it's a blood libel, they're also sending a very high-powered legal delegation, including a British expert on international law, and a former Chief Justice of Israel, Aaron Barak, who is in fact a Holocaust survivor. He was sent to a ghetto by the Nazis in Lithuania as a child, because I think what the ICJ can do, cases drag on for years, but they can issue an interim court order which could call on Israel to stop its offensive. And because of the weight of the ICJ, it's an international body that it's connected to the UN system, that is something that the Israelis have to take seriously, which is why they're not just dismissing it, they're sending over a very high-powered delegation to try to fight these accusations. And it means that Israel, in a legal context, well, I think for the first time, they will have to provide legal arguments as to why what they're doing is not in breach of the 1948 Genocide Convention. In the very long 84-page document that South Africa has submitted to the ICJ, it makes the point that genocide is distinct from other war crimes Israel is accused of in Gaza, e.g. collective punishment of civilians, though it's related to it. And the South Africans also say that this should be placed in the context of, this is a quote, 75-year apartheid, 56-year belligerent occupation of Palestinian territory, and a 16-year blockade of Gaza. And they're also citing statements by senior Israelis, there are some extreme right-wingers in the government, who have mused openly about Palestinians being moved out of Gaza somewhere else and Jewish settlers going back into that territory.
Jeremy Bowen. The president of China has always been a huge football fan, and he'd set his sights on his country becoming a soccer superpower. Before even becoming president, he outlined a three-stage plan for the men's national team to qualify for another World Cup, to host a World Cup, and to win a World Cup. Well, this dream has been dealt a bit of a blow after the former coach of China's national football team admitted landing his job through bribery. Li Tia also revealed that he'd fix matches to secure promotion for two club sides he'd once managed. He made the confessions and others in a documentary shown on national television in China. For more on this, I spoke to our Asia-Pacific editor, Mickey Bristow.
Really damning revelations here from the former coach, Li Tia, who managed the Chinese national team between 2020 and 2021. Essentially what happened was that he left the team as manager. He was then arrested for corruption, but until now nobody's really understood what he was being investigated for. But in this documentary he lays out exactly why people have been investigating him, and that's because he paid a massive bribe, nearly $500,000 in order to secure that position in the top job. And that was paid partly by him and partly by a club he was managing at the time. And in return for this club paying some of the money, he took some of their players and played them in the national team when they weren't particularly good enough. As well, you indicated there, before he even became national coach, when he was a coach of two other teams, he managed to get promotion. Now he's admitted that he did that through match fixing, by paying off referees, opposing players, managers, officials involved in the game. So a real host of corruption he's revealed in this documentary.
So as a result, other top officials are under investigation as well. But do we know why he confessed in this documentary?
We don't know why he confessed in a documentary. In fact, there hasn't been a legal process, I believe, at the moment. So he hasn't been convicted of any crime. But it's usual in China, and often happens, whereby people suspected or accused of crimes then turn up on TV confessing to these crimes. It's a way the government uses to try and tell people that it's really sorting out this problem and it's getting to the bottom of it. And corruption's a big issue, has been a big issue throughout Xi Jinping, the Chinese leader's entire time in office, but it's a particular issue now. It's come back into the fore, and I think what the Chinese authorities want to do is say they're cleaning up the game. But many, many officials at the top of the Chinese game are being implicated in this, and even at the bottom of the game, so it doesn't look good.
Mickey Bristow. Still to come in this podcast.
Come on in and check the first AI pillow of its kind, the Motion Pillow. Stop snoring tonight.
Innovations coming our way from the world's biggest tech show.
A web of manipulation and terrifying abuse.
If he'd have said to do anything, I would have done it.
With a powerful religious figure at its centre.
There was no safe place.
You don't say no to him.
World of Secrets from the BBC World Service is back with a brand new season, investigating allegations surrounding the preacher TB Joshua.
The culture of secrecy needs to be broken.
Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
To Germany now, where about 80% of trains have been cancelled as drivers begin a three-day strike over pay and working conditions. Commuters across the country have already been facing disruption due to farmers who are continuing to block roads in protest at plans to phase out fuel subsidies. Combined with a budget crisis and a lacklustre economic forecast, it's led some to brand this as Germany's winter of discontent. Our Berlin correspondent Jessica Parker reports now from the state of Brandenburg.
This demo rolls into the northeastern town of Oranienburg. Christoph Plass, a potato farmer, rages at plans to phase out a tax break on diesel fuel, but he's also angry at other environmental rules coming from government and the EU.
The farmers say, we know how to do our work. There is so much in the Green Deal that says you have to do it like that and you have to do it like this, and nobody sees what is the cost at the end.
But a lot of those measures you're talking about, they're about making farming more sustainable, greening the economy. Isn't that a good thing?
Yeah, that's a good thing, but we have to do the process with the farmers. We are not saying we cannot change anything or we won't change. We're changing since years and years and years, and now it's too much.
These demos are even getting mentions on local radio traffic reports. The level of disruption does vary. But at a nearby petrol station, Alexandra, an occupational therapist, says for her it's a big problem.
I'm a single mum. No, I'm not happy. Those who don't have much will, at the end of the year, have even less. And those who are rich will get richer.
Another motorist filling up, David, backs the farmers, but not Chancellor Olaf Scholz's coalition government.
Who do you think does have the answer in politics?
All parties have their pros and cons, but right now, Alternative for Deutschland are the only ones looking after the Germans and not others.
Many see the AfD as extremist and they're very worried about their popularity.
Well, that depends on your perspective, but I say that as long as they are fighting for us, the Germans, that's okay.
Sollen sie es auch sein?
David heads off. The far-right Alternative for Deutschland has recently been polling higher than ever before, and the party's seeking to capitalise on the farmers' protests. The tractors park up opposite the town hall, and the council leader, Dirk Blettermann, a member of Chancellor Olaf Scholz's Social Democratic Party, comes out to meet us.
There's quite a lot of talking Germany down right now. If you look at our economic prospects, it's not great. But if you look at the big profits our businesses have made, this has to all be seen in the balance.
The mood does seem quite pessimistic at the moment.
That's typically German. Either everybody is euphoric, or everything is just terrible. We don't do the middle ground.
This farmer's demo wraps up, but Germany's bracing for plenty more, culminating in an estimated 10,000 protesters descending on Berlin next week.
Jessica Parker reporting there. They must have thought it was a nice addition to the artwork. Last year, the Holy Trinity Cathedral in Georgia received a huge icon, one of those traditional Orthodox Christian paintings depicting the majestic figure of Saint Patrona. It was only this week that someone spotted another figure in the painting, Joseph Stalin, the late Soviet dictator. And now somebody has vandalised the icon, covering that image of Stalin in spray paint. Our Europe regional editor Paul Moss is following the story.
For those who aren't aware, Joseph Stalin is held responsible for the murder of millions of people in the former Soviet Union, many of them in Georgia, which was part of the Soviet Union. And he particularly persecuted priests and ordinary Christian worshippers. However, Stalin was a Georgian, maybe the most famous Georgian in history, and there are still many people in the country who remain proud of what they see as a national hero. But it also turns out this painting, the icon of St. Patrona, was donated to the church by a pro-Russian political party. Now, Georgia currently is bitterly divided between pro- and anti-Russian factions, so I think we could see this row as part of a bigger row, an ongoing struggle. I mean, there have been arguments about whether there should be direct flights between the Georgian capital and Moscow. There have been rows about how to treat all the Russians who fled to Georgia since the war with Ukraine started. And now they're having the row through the medium of this painting, which, as you say, the latest salvo, it's been covered in paint.
Sure. You say the political party that donated this painting was pro-Russian, but why would they choose to show that by effectively praising Joseph Stalin?
Well, quite simply, Vladimir Putin is a bit of a Joseph Stalin fan. I mean, since he came to power, dozens of monuments to Stalin have appeared around Russia, and he's praised Stalin as a great man, and not difficult to see why. I mean, Stalin, his name means man of steel. He ruled the Soviet Union with an iron fist. He was a militarist who tried to gobble up neighbouring countries, and indeed, after the Second World War, extended the Soviet influence into Eastern Europe. And you know what? It does seem to be working. The highly respected Levada Center for 30 years has been asking people in Russia, what do you think of Stalin? When they started 30 years ago, only 20% of Russians said they respected Stalin. By 2012, that figure had doubled. And last year, they found that nearly half of Russians respected Stalin. So, you know, that's the kind of, I think, approval ratings a lot of politicians would be very grateful for. And interestingly, more recently, they've tried to portray Stalin as a Christian figure. And it seems some Georgians want that figure in their church.
And briefly, but what's going to happen to this painting now?
Well, the police are hunting whoever did it. They think it's a well-known human rights figure. Interestingly, the church was contacted about why they had a picture of Stalin, and the priest responsible got rather angry. It's only just been Christmas in the Russian Orthodox Church, January 7th, and he just said, why are the media wanting to spoil Christmas by covering this story?
Paul Moss. And now to Las Vegas, where the world's largest consumer tech show, CES, is taking place. Thousands of companies show off their latest products, giving us a glimpse into what will soon be coming to our high streets. There will be no surprise that artificial intelligence is a key feature this year. Our North America technology reporter, James Clayton, has been trying out some of the latest products.
Come on in and check the first AI pillow of its kind, the Motion Pillow. Stop snoring tonight. Get better health and better sleep.
Is your pillow so boring that it isn't even AI capable? If I was going to summarize CES, it would boil down to companies trying to convince people that AI is needed in everything. No product can escape the tide of artificial intelligence.
I'm in one of the busiest areas right now. This is Samsung's showcase, and I'm in the AI section. And if you can imagine, there are washing machines, fridges. It's kind of like being in a Samsung shop, really. But every single wall is emblazoned with two letters, AI. All of these things are, in theory, powered by AI. They're all AI capable in some way. So I'm going to try and speak to someone and see if they can tell me, A, why do they need to be AI enabled? And B, is this actually AI?
You're going to see the AI.
Oh, so there's like an AI function.
Exactly.
Right.
This is Amy from Samsung talking me through an AI-powered vacuum cleaner, which looks very much like a normal vacuum cleaner.
Once you go into a different type of flooring, you give it just a second and you'll see that it's going to change. So it's definitely got some more power.
Right. So you've not pressed anything there.
I've not pressed anything.
I mean, do we actually need an AI vacuum cleaner, though?
Do we need it? Of course you do. I actually have done something terrible for my health. I'm allergic to cats. Do I have a cat? He's so cute. And so Ollie's hair on the rug in the living room, I can now confidently say that's coming up, and it'll help me in my health as well.
Right. So AI can help you keep having a cat.
Yes.
That's the sell.
Exactly.
Okay.
The AI fridge here can detect what food you have and suggest recipes. The washing machine can apparently detect types of fabric.
So it's learning your specific clothes.
Absolutely. So this will just get more efficient and more efficient and more efficient over time.
Right. So there is machine learning in this, because that's one of the big sort of, I guess people are slightly skeptical about some of this stuff, because it's like, is this actually AI? Is this actually machine learning? But you're saying it is.
Yes.
Elsewhere at the show, an AI mirror made by Barracuda can analyze your face and tell you what skincare regime you need.
So I'm standing in front of a round mirror. It looks like a completely normal mirror, but behind it is a screen and a camera. So I can step towards the mirror, take a picture of myself, and then, in theory, it will analyze my skin and tell me what I need to do to make my skin look better. So I'm going to have a go now.
This could be brutal. I'm quite jet-lagged. Oh, eye bag's noticeable. So it's literally given me an eye bag routine. I need cleanser,
exactly.
Peptides in my eye cream, a serum, and retinol cream.
Yes.
Pretty harsh, but maybe AI is telling me what no one else would dare to. But a word of warning about all these new AI products. 2 years ago, everyone here was talking about the metaverse. And this year, almost no one is. It's notoriously difficult in tech to work out what's a fad and what's the new big thing.
James Clayton there. Now, we want to take you to the forests of Vietnam. That is the rather beautiful sound of the world's second rarest ape, the gibbon, in its natural habitat. And this recording is significant. It's been used to help measure the population size of the critically endangered Calvit gibbon. Davina Gupta spoke to the project lead, Oliver Wen.
The local communities that we work with, they told us that they could seemingly tell apart different gibbon groups. So we wanted to try and use that idea to see if we could count them from their songs. So after setting out all these microphones in the habitat, we downloaded all the data and made spectrograms, which are visual, like pictures of the sounds. And we could see suddenly, it was like a bit of a eureka moment. We could see the different songs from the different individuals were very different. And that allowed us to count the population size much more accurately than has been possible before.
And their numbers, though, are less than 100 from what you found out, I believe. Why is that?
Yeah, so they're now found in only a single habitat, a single forest block on the border between Vietnam and China. So they live in a very small area. They're constrained. And the habitat also is not in a great state. It's been suffering from degradation for many decades. So the population is somewhat depressed at this point. But with restoration, we think the future could be hopeful for this species. And we know what we need to do. We just need to get on and restore the habitat by limiting grazing, planting trees and that kind of thing.
Do you see that females are talking more than the males? Is that something that you witnessed in this group?
So the Calvit gibbon, they sing their song as a trio. So it happens over like a 15-minute period, and the male does actually most of the singing. And then over a number of minutes, then the two females in each group, usually they suddenly sing in this big crescendo, like a vibrato, twitter-like song, which we call the Great Call. And the two females sing that in response to the male. And then the male sings again in reply to the female. So they have this coordinated kind of trio song that they do.
That was Oliver Wen. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Martin Baker, and the producer was Anna Murphy. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Mars, and until next time, goodbye.